everyone, and a very warm welcome to all the various alumni that have travelled from far and wide, from India and from America, to be here on this auspicious occasion. One interesting thing that happened to me just about 5 hours ago was that the final years had asked for a revision lecture on advanced transport processes. And I was just talking about gas-liquid absorption and reaction. And I finished the lecture, and in through the door came Professor Sharma. I just hope he wasn't listening too hard, just in case I've made any mistakes in that enhancement factor that you need for second-order reaction. Okay, well, it's a great pleasure to basically be here. What I'd like to do first off, since there are so many things we need to get through, is to welcome Sir David Harrison, who is going to tell us about a trip down memory lane. What I would say to all the speakers is, if you could stand between these two black tapes on the floor, and also if you do not want your to be videoed, to let us know, and we'll remove it from the record. Over to you, Sir David.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think I'm in the right place. I think so. I assume that the great privilege I have this afternoon is because I've known John for 60 years. Which I think probably beats anybody else in the room, including his own family. And it came about in this way. The first Shell professor, Terence Fox, was notably reluctant to appoint credited chemical engineers onto his staff when making the early staff appointments here. He was launching chemical engineering science in a skeptical and ancient university, and that's of itself a challenge. And he was anxious that he was not going to teach applied chemistry, which was chemical engineering was commonly seen to be that at the time. The United States was different, and Fox had spent a year at MIT before he had to become professor. And out of all that, he was determined that his course should focus on thermodynamics, fluid and particle flow, reaction kinetics. In short, that the students who took the course should acquire the ability to understand the underlying principles which were at the heart of the chemical and oil industries of the day. He strongly believed that graduates who'd taken this course that he was creating on an American model would make the graduates more intrinsically employable than those who had undergone a course which had set a store at a descriptive knowledge of the processes then used in the chemical industry. And in furtherance of this aim, this staff recruitment aim, he recruited young postdoctoral students in engineering or in physical chemistry. And it was that principle that led to John's arrival in 1952 and mine in 1956. In the late 1950s, both of us were drawn to research in fluidization. And in that subject was quite removed from what we'd done as graduate students. But we were encouraged by the next Shell professor, Peter Dankwitz. Now, John examined in the modest context of a TRIPOS research project the rates of rise of large spherical cap bubbles in fluidized beds and liken them successfully to the behavior of large spherical cap bubbles observed in gas liquid systems. Now this phenomenon, or these large bubbles, had been studied and described by G.I. Taylor in a paper in 1950, and in turn that work had been sort of initiated really by looking at the bubbles that are produced when you explode depth charges in World War II at sea. I mean, you get these large bubbles. And that's where it began, a TRIPOS project only at that stage. Now this man, John, was exceedingly busy at the time. Trinity elected him to an official fellowship in 1957 and promptly made him steward. At the moment, the college had decided to undertake a full refurbishment of their kitchens, their old kitchens, which had been built or set up in the first time in 1605. Now the mind boggles at the complexity and sensitivity of that job. Even the more usual task falling to college stewards in ordinary life, as it were, like setting sensitive seating plans for feasts, called upon his administrative skills. The one problem was that to get the monumentally distinguished honorary fellows of Trinity actually to say whether they were going to attend a feast or not. And somehow embarrassment had to be avoided of somebody turning up unexpected. And the only way John eventually found to solve this was to gather the private telephone numbers of these great people, and if all else failed, to phone them up at 9 p.m. on the Sunday before the feast. He then discovered whether they really were going to come or not. Now, needless to say, on top of this college work, large and small, sensitive and otherwise, he carried a very full load of teaching and examining here in the department and the supervision of a growing number of graduate students. All at the time when the department was moving from temporary accommodation in Tennis Court Road into this building. And by the way, his family with Suzanne at that time included a son aged 3 and a daughter aged 1. They can verify their ages when they speak. One of them speaks later. Yet despite all this, he formulated during this time a very elegant analysis of the exchange of gas between a rising bubble and the surrounding fluidized particulate phase. This piece of theory, described in chapter 4 of our book in 1963, was beautifully confirmed by X-ray pictures of rising bubbles containing a nitrogen dioxide tracer, all done at Harwell by Peter Rowe and his co-workers. Now John's original contribution of this theory in 1961, again modestly, was simply as a contribution to a discussion at a fluidization symposium. Now some of you may have gathered that over the years John is rather reluctant to allow too busy as an excuse for any shortfall of high quality work. Busy people can do many great things. Now, chemical engineering is an international discipline, and that's amply shown this afternoon. And over 20 years, John and I shared a number of very agreeable overseas visits in addition to periods of sabbatical leave, notably in the United States or in Australia. One of our earliest visits was to the Soviet Union in 1966 at the invitation of the Soviet Academy of Sciences. At a time we had planned was to have time in Moscow and in Leningrad, as it used to be called. But it proved quite impossible to obtain in advance any information about our visit. in other words, to answer questions from our wives. We were, you know, off into the blue sky. Anyway, but on the first night in Moscow, the kind folks who actually had been in Cambridge on a visit the year before, so we did know them, that much at least, produced a handwritten itinerary for our 16 days in the Soviet Union. It looked very attractive, because in addition to visits to universities and research institutes, there were, you know, several scheduled visits to the Bolshoi in the midst of it all. And we were then asked, having gone through this, we were then asked whether we thought anything or anybody had been missed from this itinerary, this program. And we thought, naive though we were, that the question had some substance. And we mentioned correspondence we'd had with a research group in Minsk. Well, it became very clear then that not only was Minsk an awful long way off, it was very clear also that the handwritten itinerary was not subject to any possible kind of change at all. So we quickly expressed our appreciation of the program, of course. However, when we lectured in Leningrad, the Minsk people were in the audience. Now there's a command. That's how you manage your country if you can. Yes, well. Now, as you will be well aware, John's great strength is his capacity to bring together pertinent experiments with very elegant theory. And I saw this in action in 1970 at Chemica, which was the first truly international conference put together by the Australian ICHEMI and the Australian Academy of Science. The home team couldn't make up their minds whether the conference should be in Sydney or Melbourne. And so they settled for it in both places, you know, 1 week in one and 1 week in the other, which was good for the visitor, good for the visitor. Anyway, in Melbourne, I was sitting next to John at a presentation of a paper from a British university which examined water droplets falling from a jet. Now, the experimentation was good, there's no doubt about that. But the authors had made awfully heavy weather about when it came to some analysis of their results. And during this time, John was sitting with a piece of graph paper in his hand, and when it came to the discussion, he contributed. Again, courteous as ever, he complimented the authors on their experimental results. And then he dropped essentially a bombshell by saying that their results could readily be interpreted by Newton's laws of motion. And they might care to have a look at the graph that he just produced, like you like this. It's not for nothing that this man has been a member of Newton's College for over 70 years. Now, John was president of ICHEMI in that year, 1970, and we were accompanied around Australia by David Sharp, who was then the general secretary of the institution. And he was utterly bemused that at all our city calls down under, we were handsomely welcomed by either former students or former senior visitors to this department. And thereafter, he always referred to his time in the hands of the Cambridge Mafia. Now, I finish really with one mention of John's contribution outside Cambridge. Because on the 1st of June 1974, there was a devastating explosion at Flixborough in Lincolnshire, which killed 28 people and injured 36 more. The Department of Employment decided at once to set up a court of inquiry. And John very soon received a telephone message from the Office of the Secretary of State, who actually at that time was Michael Foote, inviting him to join the Court of Inquiry. John, being a cautious man, just thought it worth mentioning that he expected to go on sabbatical leave to Australia in January 1975, only to be assured by the civil servant in London that that didn't cause any bother at all, because the Court of Inquiry, of course, would be all over before the end of 1974. Well, Well, not so, as you can very well imagine. 70 days of public hearing, and those only finished in February 1975, and the sabbatical leave had to be deferred. Well, but in the context of an appalling, tragic event, I think John, the chemical engineer, found the inquiry intellectually absorbing, and it certainly gave rise to one or two tripos problems. Now, just a final footnote. Anyone who has an entry in Who's Who is allowed to enter, if they so care, their recreations. And John has one which I've never seen anywhere else or from anybody else, and that is mending domestic artifacts. He is unique in mending domestic artifacts. Some years ago, I congratulated a friend on his 90th birthday, and he said, "It's nothing to do with merit, it just means you've been around a long time." Now, John, there's been a lot of merit around, and that's what we're celebrating this afternoon. Thank you very much.